Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, I'm a third-generation Floridian, actually a third-generation Miamian, a fairly rare thing now for someone my age. So as a kid, I was certainly aware of the native Seminole tribe of Florida. When my family would sometimes drive out into the agricultural areas south of Lake Okeechobee or along the Tamiami Trail, we would often see groups of Seminoles in their distinctive colorful dress, working or maybe selling tourist things by the roadside. And when I was a teenager, I would go exploring by canoe into the Everglades, and at one point I ran across a small Seminole family encampment. They let me sit on a log at the edge of their camp and watch them for an hour or so going about their business, which was interesting. But beyond that, really, I never gave the Seminoles much thought. It wasn't until I was a young adult that I learned about the several wars in the mid-1800s between the U.S. Army and the Seminoles, and that they are the only truly undefeated Native American tribe. And also that the Seminoles aren't really a distinct original tribe indigenous to Florida, but actually are a kind of melange of Creeks and Miccosukees from Georgia and Alabama who lived alongside runaway slaves in the 18th and 19th centuries. So since many of our listeners are in Florida and might not know this history, that's the part I'd like to focus on today, the connection between Africans and Indians that helped make the Seminole tribe. And we have with us as my guest the perfect person to help us do that. He's Dr. Andrew Frank, a history professor at Florida State University, who's an expert on the history of the Seminoles. In fact, one of his recent studies is called Red, Black, and Seminole: Community Convergence on the Florida Borderlands. Welcome, Dr. Frank.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Court.
Well, thanks for being on. Looking forward to it. Can we call you Andrew?
By all means.
Okay, good. Well, why don't we start off where I left off? How and when did the early Seminoles appear in Florida?
Well, it's a great way to start. So Seminoles will say that some of them have been here forever, but the name Seminole, or a community that becomes known as Seminole, is really an 18th century appearance. And so the Seminoles in the Spanish records and the English records and eventually the U.S. records, they become kind of a catch-all phrase for all the Indians in Florida that are outside of the control of the missions or outside of the control of Creek society in Georgia, Alabama, and beyond. And so they are, as you said in the introduction, they are melange. There are lots of different ancestors to the Seminoles. But as a people, they are an 18th century, really should be 19th century phenomenon, somewhere between the two, say 1750 to 1800-ish.
Okay. So since they are pretty new as tribes go, what is the name Seminole, where does it come from?
Again, this is really good. This gets at the same type of issue. So the term Seminole, according to most, translates to wild or runaway, more poetically, those who camp at a distance or those at distant fire. Creeks use it quite a bit, Creek Indians in Georgia, who are trying to build their new people as well, with ancient ancestors, but all the disruptions of colonialism basically shatter the Southeast, and the Creeks are forming and trying to form a centralized nation. And there are these indigenous groups, these towns in Florida and partly and sometimes in Georgia, that are out of their control. And so they call them wild or runaway. They want to label them as criminals. The Seminoles themselves, or the Indians in Florida, they never considered themselves to be runaways. Very few people consider themselves to be runaways. But they translated or understood it to be free or at a distance. One man's wild, dangerous person is another man's freedom fighter.
Sure, right. So, and I know that the actual indigenous Florida natives were tribes called Tequesta and Calusa and Tumuqua and many others. I mean, you know, at least a dozen all around Florida. And as you kind of alluded to, Andrew, they were devastated by disease and warfare with the Spanish and the British and the Americans, and probably only a few, or really a few of them left by the 1700s. But were some of these original people, you know, still alive by the time the Creeks were splitting off in Florida in enough numbers to at least contribute to what became the Seminole tribe?
Well, the short answer is yes. So it's we will never know the number, right? It's very hard to get any sort of demographic information out of kind of the, around 1700 in Florida. Outsiders usually called it empty, but within their descriptions of emptiness, they refer to towns that are still here or survivors who are still here. The earliest oral histories and the earliest histories that we have of the migrants, these Creek migrants coming in from what is now Georgia into Florida, they refer to people who were here when they got here. So we don't know how many where they are here, but there are certainly oral traditions and some pretty good evidence that some of the Calusa down by what is now Naples on the west coast of Florida, there were certainly some survivors there. And then where what is now Miami, the Tequesta, they weren't called the Tequesta anymore. Like there was all Hostas Indians in the Spanish documents, sometimes Miamias, but not because that was actually their name, but they were just trying to find a way to characterize based on the geography of where they were, who these people were. And they were from all over Florida. There's a likelihood that some of them were from North Florida, but in terms of distinguishing who is who, it's very hard. But it's clear that we have these migrants from Georgia who become known as Creeks. They come into Florida. Miccosukees come in, Hitchity speakers, and they meet up with some other folks who are here, and slowly they form independent towns, and slowly they coalesce and ultimately become a tribe or multiple tribes.
Interesting. When you think about it, it's kind of a, in a microcosm, sort of reflects America. It's kind of a melting pot, right?
That's absolutely right. Right. So we have this idea often of indigenous people being the same tribe going back forever. And sometimes that's the case, but often, just like European nations, when faced with calamities in the United States or what is now the United States, there's this massive depopulation that takes place and this shattering of communities. To survive, they form new people. I mean, it doesn't make them any less indigenous. It just means that their polity, their political organization necessarily has to change.
And
so, yeah, it's very much like the United States, right? How long has the United States been here? Right, 1776, right? But how long have their ancestors been in North America? Well, we can go back much further than that, right? And so they have history before history.
So I think there are officially three related but separate tribes of Seminole today. So what are they? Why don't you explain that kind of briefly?
Well, there are, I guess it depends how you frame this. So we have the Seminole Tribe of Florida, which is the federally recognized group of Seminoles that live in Florida. There's a Seminole Nation in Oklahoma who are historically connected, but with removal in the 19th century, they ultimately become two people, connected historically, but in terms of their politics and their community and sometimes their culture, they're different. There's the Miccosukee Indian Nation of Florida, which is also in South Florida, again, connected historically. But in the 1960s, early 60s, they separate from the Seminoles who were recognized in the 1950s. So all of these individuals kind of trace their lineage back to the same group of people that we imagine being the Seminoles in the 19th century. Hmm. And then there's actually a fourth group who are not federally recognized, but are recognized by the Miccosukees and the Seminoles as independents. And these are Native Americans in South Florida who, for various reasons, have decided that they don't want to be members of the Seminole Tribe of Florida or Miccosukee Tribe, but they're acknowledged as members of their community. So some of them historically have said, if we embrace this idea that we are a citizen of the Seminole Tribe of Florida, then the fight for independence is lost. Because, of course, the Seminole Tribe of Florida is the Seminole Tribe of Florida in some ways because it's recognized by the federal government. And they don't want to recognize the federal government as having any control over their lives. But at Greenhorn Ceremony, they often dance together and they interact with one another and they talk with one. Like, they are sometimes members of the same community, just not members of the same nation.
Yeah, so it's a political entity then, basically.
It's a political entity, yeah.
But interesting with the Miccosukee, though, so you said they're in southern Florida, I guess, you know, south of Lake Okeechobee, but are they, even though there's a separate Seminole Tribe of Florida, are they really the same people? I mean, their antecedents, their genetics, their ancestors are identical, and is their culture very much the same, or are they distinct from your point of view as an ethno-historian and as somebody who really focuses on this professionally? Do they have enough distinctions to be different, or is it just kind of an artificial distinction?
So the Seminoles, I mean, I'm going to answer the question backwards. The Seminole Tribe of Florida has tremendous ethnic and linguistic and cultural distinctions within it, right? There are some attributes or some traits that historically and in the contemporary world, Seminoles embrace. The idea of a chiqui, a home, a thatched roof home, as being the center of their community, or the historically has been the case, patchwork clothing, and before that, appliqué. But the Seminole Tribe of Florida has two official languages. They speak Miccosukee and Seminole, or Miccosukee, which is Hitchity language, or Seminole, which is Creek. The Miccosukees speak Miccosukee. And so the distinction between the two, the Miccosukees would say, and I think rightfully, that they've always been distinct from other communities, indigenous communities in Florida. And the Seminoles get formed in 1957 out of this threat that their reservations are going to be taken away from them. The federal government says in the 50s, we're going to terminate Indian tribes, and they look at the Seminoles, somehow they get put on this list for termination. And in response, a group of Seminole leaders say, wait, what if we form a centralized government? And what if we create a constitution? Can you allow us to survive and keep our sovereignty? And ultimately, through a pretty bitter fight, the United States reluctantly says yes. But during the whole fight, there's this group of Miccosukees who say, no, wait, we're not Seminoles. we've always been distinct. You think we're the same, and from the outside looking in, we may look the same, but we're not the same people. And in 63, the Miccosukees are now this separate federally recognized group. And there are some Miccosukee speakers who were then members of the Seminole tribe. They had to decide, well, where do they belong? So if you go to the Big Cypress Reservation, if individuals who live there are speaking an indigenous language, they're speaking Miccosukee, they're not speaking Creek or Seminole, right? So historically, they knew who was who. Outsiders often blur the difference.
Sure. It sounds like the distinctions among denominations of Protestantism almost kind of breaks down
exactly
that way.
That's exactly right. Yeah, try to convince people what the shared culture of the United States is.
There you go.
It's a hard question.
So, like, backing up to, you know, before the Seminole Wars, Andrew, which decimated the tribe, as all those Indian wars did with the Indians that were their subject and object. But what was their culture like there in Florida before they were upended like that? I mean, was it pretty much Stone Age hand to mouth, or was it, agrarian kind of, you know, what was it like? Was it pretty elaborate and pretty together?
Well, it was very much together and very diverse. So I'll give you a couple of examples. So in what is now Tallahassee, right, in the what was then Middle Florida, the Seminoles or the villages that were here looked very much like, say, Cherokee or Creek villages elsewhere. They were agriculturalists, corn, beans, and squash. Women controlled the fields. It was a matrilineal society. Men were hunters or warriors or diplomats. They controlled what happened outside of villages. And they had pretty elaborate crafts, and they traded really long distances. They used dugout canoes with sails, and they would get pretty far into the Caribbean and into the interior of the United States. And so that's kind of your panhandle version. And if you move down to, say, Alachua, they were cattle herders, right? The most famous being Cowkeeper. But Payne's Prairie is named for Chief Payne. He was a cattleman as well. Micanopy was a cattleman. So cattle is now a very important part of Seminole culture in the 21st century. And many of these families who are cattle herders today say they're just repeating what their ancestors did, they would say, not too long ago or long ago. But there's a very influential cattle herding family called the Johns family on the Brighton Reservation and elsewhere. And they say they get their name from the St. Johns River because they would be driving cattle up and down the St. Johns River, right? This northward flowing river and the headwaters are pretty darn close to the Brighton Reservation. And so that's kind of two versions of it. And if you go all the way south to, say, what is now Miami, Tamiami Trail, corn, beans, and squash don't grow there. It's much more wetlands. And they lived really dependent on the waterways. Villages were a little bit smaller. They were at a distance from one another. And they grew small gardens on kind of hammocks and things like that. But they also harvested kunti, which is this plant that grows naturally along South Florida, and the roots are scrapable and soakable to get the toxins out, and you can make breads out of it and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so, right, so we have these multiple versions of what it means culturally to be Seminole at the kind of the onset of war. And then war comes, and the United States calls it the Seminole War, and they kind of lump together all these groups of indigenous people when they call them all Seminoles, because and we do this as U.S. military a lot. We take an enemy with lots of distinctions within them, and then we try to create a who's the president, who's the prime minister, who's the defense secretary, right? We try to create a hierarchy so we can understand them and wage war on them.
Yeah, while simplifying and demonizing them if you can, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We are talking with Professor Andrew Frank, who's an historian at history professor at Florida State University, about his field of study, which is the Seminole Indian Tribe of Florida. And I want to turn now to what I said would be the main focus of our show today. When and how did African Americans encounter the Seminole, and how did that contact develop over time?
Oh, that's a fun question. African Americans have been in Florida basically as long as the Spanish have been in Florida, right? So the very earliest Spanish voyages into Florida, the African Americans were along with them. Gene Landers has done some really amazing work on this. But when we talk about African Americans encountering the Seminoles, they're also there basically from, I don't want to say the beginning, because Seminoles would say they have been here forever, but they're from the beginning of the moment that Seminoles start to coalesce and see the commonalities between the various villages in Florida. So African Americans, enslaved people from Georgia, Spanish colonies, and beyond, they find freedom in the interior of Florida, in the region that I would call Seminole country or Indian country, where we tend to think of Spanish Florida as this place under Spanish control. But if you weren't on the straight line between St. Augustine and Pensacola, and even some of those places in between. But if you were anywhere south of there, you were far beyond kind of the eyes of the Spanish crown or the British crown or the United States ultimately. So enslaved people would find freedom and they would create what we would call maroon communities down there, which are independently predominantly African-American or predominantly African communities that run independently, and they try not to be seen, if you will, by the colonial powers. So often maroon communities, in Florida it works a little differently, but maroon communities in Georgia would be in the Great Dismal Swamp, right, out of the eyes, or in Appalachia, up in the mountains, in the interior, far beyond where people, white people, can kind of get their hands on them. And so these African-Americans come into Florida, but they're not entering empty land. They're entering land inhabited by what we call Seminoles. And so slowly they start having trade relations, friendships, sometimes marriages, although not as often as we often imagine. And just like various indigenous villages slowly get to know one another, despite their various differences, the African villages are there as well.
So they're kind of neighbors and allies and trading partners and kind of coexisted, I guess, from what you're saying.
Yeah, well, they coexist. And over the course of time, coexistence, right, if you have the same set of neighbors over time, one generation isn't very much, but if it's multiple generations, a handful of marriages, a handful of trading relationships, a handful of alliances where they wage war on the same side, friendships become deeper. Hard to know what that kind of comes to, right? There's no polity that we could say there was a Seminole National Council where there was representation on it. But it's clear that they're more than just neighbors.
Okay.
And there's an indigenous tradition for this, right? So we could look in Georgia where some of these creeks become Seminoles. There's lots of what we call mother-daughter towns. So a mother town either gets so big that some members of the community move off, and they are subservient, maybe too strong of a word, but it's close enough. They are allied, but it's clear who is the boss, if you will, and in the matrilineal world, mother has significance, but daughter also is free. And so we have records of Black Seminoles paying what we would call tribute. Often in the sources, they're called taxation, but throughout the indigenous world, communities would pay small amounts of symbolic, sometimes corn or some sort of goods, and it would be passed up to kind of a main leader, and that leader would then redistribute it at harvest time. And like, this is what they would use to save them from famine or to wage, kind of raise an army. So we can see that there are these connections between these African-American villages and indigenous villages. The course of time, as the wars, the 19th century is approaching, those connections are becoming much more firm.
Okay. So kind of a somewhat feudal type of situation, and maybe a sharecropper kind of relationship in a way, but at least on that side of it. But you mentioned the term Black Seminoles. Who called them that? Did they call themselves that, or did the U.S. government call them that, or was that a common term used at the time?
That would be a U.S. government or a U.S. military, right? We have very few records by indigenous people when they enter the record, like at treaties or when they give speeches. The term Black Seminole is not a term that they use. But it's clear that indigenous folks are trying to often resist efforts by the United States to come in and kind of capture runaway slaves. But to complicate things a little bit more, some Seminoles own slaves. So within a village, you can have, or within a collection of villages, you would see enslaved people, you would see free Black, you would see free indigenous people with African ancestry, and you would see free folks who are, whatever, indigenous, for lack of a better word, right? So you have this new culture, this new community that is forming, in part modeled with enslavement, and in part modeled with this idea that Africans can be free.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because I did see, you know, in reading kind of to prepare for the show, I read that, you know, some African-Americans were leading very prosperous, independent lives alongside the Seminole, with, you know, farms that were in some cases more impressive and bigger and prosperous than the Seminole farms. And in other cases, they, as you said, were enslaved by Seminoles. So that's quite a stratification. It's strange to think, you know, obviously the dynamics of a society are complex and too hard to talk about in a few minutes. But it's just interesting to see that range of relationships would coexist at the same time, right?
I think one easy way to imagine it is that Seminoles didn't have this concept of race that was so pervasive in the United States or Spain or elsewhere in kind of the colonial world. And so if people were enslaved and they had notions of enslavement that go back and captivity that go back into the indigenous world for a very long time. And so enslaved people are enslaved people and free people are free people. So I don't see anything in the records that makes it seem like Seminoles are enslaving Africans that come into Florida, but they're purchasing them instead on the market. So they're not slave hunters, if you will, but they're participating in the marketplace. And one of the things you can purchase in the marketplace are enslaved people.
I know that bounty hunters often hunted runaway slaves far and wide and were brutal in how they did it and very effective at it because that's what they did for a living. So did they come down looking for runaways in Seminole areas of Florida? And if so, how did that dynamic play out?
Absolutely, they came. Slave hunters were plentiful. They worked with permission of the various governments that were there. Often, sometimes the bounties were paid by the federal government, by Indian agents. And they came in, and it was a part of almost every treaty negotiation. The United States would try to say, okay, you will give up land, but you'll also give up the African-Americans who are in your vicinity. And the dynamic worked out very poorly for the United States, usually, because that was almost always, when it came to treaties, a line that Seminoles would not cross. And so sometimes ransoms would be paid, and Seminoles would take enslaved people and return them, if you will. But very rarely did we see free African Americans who are these maroons, if you will. Very rarely do we see those individuals being returned back to the United States or to their presumed former owners, people who claimed them. But one way to think of the Second Seminole War, in many ways, it really was an extended slave raid, right? Much of the Second Seminole War takes place in a region that the United States doesn't actually particularly want. Right, we tend to think of Indian removal as this great attempt by the United States to claim lands that they can then turn into cotton fields with slave labor. And that really is the Indian Removal Act. But when you get to the interior of Florida, no one is eyeing Alachua as this great cotton country. They eyed Tallahassee as great cotton country, but not Alachua, let alone the Everglades. The value that's in that territory are enslaved people and cattle, right? That's the movable property that can be taken home. And hundreds of enslaved people are captured during the war and thousands of head of cattle. So it's profit seeking, right? It's pretty horrid, despicable kind of set of repeated actions.
Yeah, but normal at the time, right? So,
correct.
So Andrew, you've mentioned a couple times the kind of unusual term maroon, which reminds me of the idea of marooned, like a castaway on a desert island or something. I mean, how did that term get to be attached to the black runaway slaves that were down in Florida?
Well, the easiest way to understand it is maroons is a term that exists in multiple languages to describe people who are maroonage. It's right as you describe it, is very much a universal trait. And so we would refer to, or they would refer to, African maroons as these group of people who are stranded, but intentionally stranded in the place that they don't want to be found. And so there are these really large maroon communities in the Caribbean, Jamaica, and elsewhere, thousands of formerly enslaved people. And in the United States and elsewhere in North America, there are these maroon communities. And so that becomes one of the ways in which intellectually we can conceptualize who these African Americans were in Florida. But the big caveat is that they did want to be seen because they had these relationships with their indigenous neighbors that make them hiding. But they're really hiding from colonial officials or imperial officials, not just hiding in general.
Yeah, interesting. What role did the Black Seminoles play in the Seminole Wars? I think you mentioned that they fought alongside the Seminoles and vice versa. So what was that like, just quickly?
So some of the Seminoles just fought as warriors, but many, especially those who spoke English and were able to speak either Hitchichi or Seminole, they would serve as interpreters. And interpreters were often advisors as well, right? If you can interpret and you're the only interpreter somewhere, that gives you a tremendous amount of power, right? So there's this interpreter named Abraham, and I can't prove it, but I'm fairly convinced that when he's told, all right, part of the treaty is going to be you have to return all the enslaved people in Florida, what he tells the rest of the indigenous people who are there, what's happening, probably comes out of a social condition, right? He probably says something they want. They want everything. Just say no. I have no proof, but if kind of common sense would say, he would be a voice of they want the impossible. It wouldn't be in his best interest to relate word for word what they actually want. But Black Seminoles are playing a part of this role, so much so that during the war, the United States offers freedom out west to any African American who's willing to lay down his gun and move. And so lots of Black Seminole men did that, 600. And they and their families went to Indian country because the fear of being enslaved and staying with the hope of staying in Florida was not as good as kind of this notion of freedom, even in an unknown country that's Indian territory, now Oklahoma.
Yeah. Even if you didn't necessarily trust the government that was offering you that deal, it was still the better of the best of
the United States actually stayed with that deal remarkable way. And so that's right. They were trying to end this war in Florida. They'd like divide and conquer. Didn't work as well as they hoped, but that's as it most of their attempts.
So you've kind of answered this in a way, Andrew, but you know, how well and how long did this relationship, let's call it symbiosis, between Blacks and Seminoles last during and particularly after the wars? I mean, did they keep the same kind of relationship they had or become more separate, or, you know, just kind of in a nutshell, we're getting sort of toward the end of the show.
Yeah, so I think it's a little bit of both. So most Black Seminoles find their way out west, either by being captured or through these voluntary surrenders, and they go out west in order to have their freedom. There's certainly lots of African Seminole families, and they simply become Seminoles, right? Their lineage is less important than their clan. You take your clan from your mother. If your mother is Seminole, you're Seminole. And over the course of time, if you're Wind Clan, you're Wind Clan. And no one in 1900 is paying attention very much to African heritage that goes back to the 1820s. But there are also some Black communities in Florida that claim that they are descendant of Black Seminoles, or at least descendant of Maroons. They don't see themselves as having Seminole connections other than through alliance. But in the parlance of the 19th century, they would have been considered Black Seminoles, although there's nothing particularly Seminole about them.
So it sounds like the Seminole tribe of Florida today, at least to some extent, recognizes in their own history the relationship that the tribe had with African Americans back in the 18th and 19th centuries, but maybe it's uneven, I guess. So, but in general, how do they see it? Do they talk about it much, or is it just kind of, you know, under the table, under the radar? What's that like, just briefly?
Well, candidly, I don't hear much about the 19th century. I hear a lot about them being unconquered, and there are certain stories of how they survive. But I don't hear much in discussions of race in the 19th century at all. If it's discussions of race, it's about white racism against Native Americans or against the Seminoles or against their people and the great pressures on them to find ways to survive in really inhospitable moments.
Well, Dr. Andrew Frank is currently writing a book on the history of the Florida Seminoles, tentatively entitled Those Who Camp at a Distance. He mentioned that earlier. Those Who Camp at a Distance, The Seminoles and Indians of Florida. It's not out yet, but you can Google him and find lots of his work online, a book that he published in 2017 entitled Before the Pioneers, Indians, Settlers, Slaves, and the Founding of Miami is, like it sounds, a history of the 2,000 years of what is now Miami before the modern developers arrived in the early 20th century. So it's all interesting stuff, and I hope you've enjoyed this show, a little bit of a snapshot of the history of the Seminoles, about a world far different from what we see today, right? You can also go to www.simtribe.com to learn more about the history of the tribe. And it's a really nice and, you know, informative website. So simtribe.com. Well, Dr. Andrew Frank, I sure appreciate you being on. It's been very interesting.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate your time.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.